double more. They hit the cap. They couldn't go above. Okay, folks. So, reminder in case you need this very late reminder that your mystery project is due by 5 p.m. today. Okay? And please don't forget to put in the subject, no mystery here. Okay? If you add extra words, it's okay. As long as those three words are in there, then it's the smart mailbox will figure it out. Right? And I have to get on a flight at like 5:30, and I want all of them in one mailbox, so I, you know, that I can grade while I'm on the flight. Okay? So, San Francisco. I'm going to San Francisco on United. Okay. Just in case I don't make it back. You know, I have lots of witnesses that I said I was going to get on a flight. Okay? Anyway, today we're going to talk about options. And as I said, I'm going to give you a very quick review on option pricing. So if you've forgotten everything there is to know about option pricing, the next 35 or 40 minutes, I'll give you a quick review of it. You're saying, but this is a valuation class. Why are we talking about options? So let me lay the foundations. So this is the start of the class, you know, the standard questions. So let's assume you have a small startup company. It's come up with this new technology. The new technology allows you to, if you have a smartphone, to speed up the flow of information. It's much more efficient about dealing with information. And given that everybody's downloading everything on smartphones now, obviously this is a technology that the big companies want. Here's the problem, though. Right now, the cost of implementing this technology is $2 billion, and the value that you think you can get based on implementing the technology today is $1.5 billion. So if I asked you, would you implement this technology today, what's your answer? No, because my value is $1.5 billion. No, it cost me $2 billion. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. The technology implemented today doesn't work. It's not feasible. But let's assume you were approached by a smartphone manufacturer, Apple or Samsung. Okay? If you are a smartphone manufacturer looking at this technology, even though it's not viable, would you be willing to pay for this technology today? And if so, why? You remember corporate finance? Okay? If this were a project, what's the net present value of this project? Minus $500 million, right? So what's the question I'm asking you? Would you pay for the rights to a negative net present value project? And if so, why? Because if you can answer that, you're going to see why we care about options. This project is not viable today. Why? Because the value of the cash flows is less. But you have the rights to this technology, let's say, for the next 15 years. So what are you hoping will happen? Louis? It's either cheaper to make or the market will get bigger. Maybe everybody's getting everything on smartphones 2 years from now, and the $1.5 billion could become $8 billion, $10 billion, $15 billion. So right now the technology is not viable, but it could become viable in the future. You just bought yourself an option. You know what the essence of an option is. Right now the option might not be something you'd exercise, but it could become valuable in the future. I'm going to talk about the option to delay, exactly this option, and why you might be able to use it to value patents, licenses, exclusive rights. So that's the first one. Let's try this. Assuming that you are willing to bid for this technology, I want you to tell me, so I want you to put yourself in the shoes of Apple or Samsung. You're looking at this non-viable technology, and I want you to think about how much you would pay for this technology as a function of a couple of variables. The first is, let's say I have 20 years left of exclusive rights to this technology as opposed to 10. Would you pay more or less? More. Why? Because the more time I get you to play on it, there's a greater chance that the $1.5 billion in value could become $10 billion or $15 billion. And here's the second one. And this is where everything we've talked about in valuation is going to be turned on its head. Let's assume there's more uncertainty about the future in this business. Would you be willing to pay more for this technology or less for this technology? Everything we've talked about so far, it seems like higher risk, lower value, right? But what's different here? Fernando. fact, let's take it to the extreme. Let's suppose I told you this technology was, everything was certain in this business. Everything was stable. You wouldn't even pay for this technology because nothing's going to change. This is going to be a horrible investment forever. You actually want more uncertainty rather than less uncertainty. And that's one of the things I'm going to talk about today is once you identify something as an option, the more uncertainty there is about the future, the greater the value is going to be of that asset. Finally, let's assume you do buy the technology and it does become viable. 2 years in, 1.5 years in. You know what I mean by viable, right? The present value of the cash flows now exceeds the cost. Would you develop the technology right away? Seems like a no-brainer. Of course you should, right? But if you think in terms of options, what's the question I'm asking? The minute an option goes in the money, would you exercise the option? The answer is there's a time premium left on the option. By waiting, you might find out more about this technology, be able to do it better. So there might be a point where the technology becomes viable, but you sit and wait hoping that you can make it an even better technology. Everything you talk about in options is embedded in this question. And we're going to use this as one of the examples for why we care about options. So let's turn to the third packet. If you brought your third packet, great. If not, make sure you get it soon. Because we're going to start talking about options. Let me give you the foundations for why real options have become the hardest concept in corporate finance and valuation. I'll give you a contrast. 20 years ago, I remember, or maybe 18 years ago, going on Amazon. This was a still young Amazon, mostly a book retailer, and typing in the word real option to see how many books I could find on real options. And 18 years ago, there were 2 books on real options. That's it. Today, you type in real options on Amazon, you see hundreds of books. Clearly, this has become a hard concept. You walk into McKinsey. They have a team, a real options team, that goes around McKinsey looking for places where they can use real options technology. CSFB's equity research department hired 2 people to bring in real options ways of thinking about valuation. For whatever reason, real options have become part of corporate finance. And I want to give you a cynical reason for why that might be. When you think about a traditional project, you take the cash flows, you take the present value, subtract out the initial investment. That's called a static analysis. You're saying, if I had to invest in this technology today, what is it worth? But when you do that, you are missing some options. Options like what? Options like the one I described, which is, if you get the exclusive rights, delaying doing this might make this bad project into a good project. We're going to talk about the option to delay. Here's the second one. By taking a bad project, you might get the rights to much bigger, better projects in the future. And I'll give you a very simple example to think about it. For about 20 years, if you look at every company globally, the country they want to end up in is China. And I'll make a blanket statement. Most companies that have invested in China have really not made much money in China. In fact, they've lost money. So if you look at a traditional project and say, should I go into China and I invest? You look at the net present value, it's negative. You're saying, I shouldn't do it. But they did it anyway. Why? What is the allure of China that leads these companies to take a negative net present value investment? What are they hoping could happen? Scared. Basically, if you're a hotel company, open 10 hotels in China, even if you believe the there's negative net present value, if it does work out, what are you hoping for? A much bigger market. That's called the option to expand. And when you have the option to expand, sometimes you will take bad projects because you hope it'll give you rights to some really big markets or really big businesses. In fact, when people talk about strategic investments, if they really mean what they're saying, this is what they're talking about. Let's take a bad investment, and it's okay because it'll give us the rights to a really good investment. And finally, there's the option to abandon. Let me explain that. Let's say I came to you with a 25-year long-term infrastructure project and ask you to do capital budgeting. What do? You project out the initial investment, then you project out the cash flows for the next 25 years, you give me a net present value, right? Let's say the net present value is positive and I take the project. 2 years into the project, I realize cash flows are coming in at 50% of what you forecast them to be. Now, if I'm stuck in my capital budgeting world, what am I required to do? Hold on to this project for the remaining 23 years and accept those lower cash flows, right? But what's the other option you have? If you really feel that this project is not delivering the cash flows you need, you could abandon it. It's It's called the option to abandon. And I'm going to argue that in some businesses, some valuations, having the option to abandon can make the business more valuable. I call this being able to walk away from your mistakes. And companies don't always think this through, but sometimes building in that flexibility can make your business more valuable. In summary, whenever we talk about real options, here's what we're asking people to do. We're asking them to do a traditional discounted cash flow valuation and add a premium on top. That's basically what options allow you to do. You're going to say, this project, if I base it just on cash flows, is worth only $80, but if I have this real option, it's worth $112. So I'm going to start off with an intuitive explanation for what gives these options value. And I'm going to show you a very simple decision tree. So here's what the decision tree looks like. You're at today. You have two possibilities in the next period. You can have success or failure, 50-50 shot. If you succeed, you make $100 million. If you fail, you lose $120 million. What's the expected value of this bet? It's minus 10, you won't do it, right? So it's pretty straightforward. I'm going to take this bet and break it up a little bit, and you tell me whether anything's changed. So in this bet, I've given you two sub-bets. In the first sub-bet, there's a 75% chance of succeeding, in which case you make $20 million, and there's a 25% chance of failure, in which case you lose $20 million. If you succeed, then you have a follow-up bet where there's a two-thirds chance of winning, in which case you make $80 million, and a one-third chance of losing, in which case you lose $100 million. What's the probability that I will win in this bet? How do I compute the probability of success? 3/4 times 2/3, and that works out to 1/2. 1/4. So basically, there's a 50% chance of winning and a 50% chance of losing, just like in the previous case. If I win, cumulatively, I make $100 million. If I lose, I lose $120 million. So if you think about it, I've given you an investment that looks very much like the previous one in terms of consolidated numbers. But here's the magic. When I take an expected value for this decision tree, it's actually a positive number. So here's my question to you. My original decision tree, I got a negative expected value. By breaking it up into two sub-branches, I've converted that negative net present value into a positive net present value. Tell me where the additional value is coming from. What is it about the second tree that makes you more willing to invest than the first one? What's happening? Sam? And tell me what it is about the second tree that makes it have a higher probability. You get this little first branch, right? What do you get to observe in the first branch? You get to observe whether you get a good outcome or a bad outcome. If you get a bad outcome, what do? You stop. If you get a good outcome, you continue. There are two things that drive the value. The first is you learn by observing what's happening. That's what the first branch gives you. And then you adapt your behavior based on what you observe in the first branch. Learning and adaptive behavior. That's at the heart of real options. See, who cares? Let's suppose you're valuing an oil company. Traditional DCF valuation, what do? Like Royal Dutch? We project out an expected oil price. We project out expected production. We come up with expected revenues. We subtract out costs. We come up with expected cash flows. We discount it all back and say the value of this oil company is $40 per share. What are we missing when we do that? Even if we're being unbiased in our expectations, what am I missing when I take an expected oil price times oil production? What do you as a CEO or a management of the oil company get to do that I'm missing in the DCF? At the start of every year, what do you observe? You observe the oil price, right? Which can be very different from the $40 today. Let's suppose oil prices a year from now go to $80. You don't produce the same amount of oil you have produced at $40. You produce a lot more oil. If the oil price goes to $15, you produce a lot less oil. Learning by looking at the oil price and adjusting your production to reflect the fact that high oil prices should be high production. That's an optionality, which effectively means you've done a discounted cash flow valuation of an oil company like I did with Royal Dutch. I've probably underestimated its value. And I could probably extrapolate from that to any natural resource company. I'm going to undervalue the company because I'm missing the optionality. So the reason we're going to talk about options is not because I want to price traditional listed options. That's for a different class. This is a futures and options class where you can learn that. This is to bring in option pricing to help me value some types of businesses. So I'm going to set out the framework I'm going to use because this is a very dangerous door I've opened. Because what am I letting you do? I'm letting you override the numbers and say, I'm going to do this because there's an option to delay, option to abandon. So I want to make sure you're doing it in the right places. So here are the three questions I'm going to ask to see if I can apply options in valuation. The first question I'm going to ask is, is there really an option in there? What makes an option an option? So I'm going to start off with a very basic question. How do I know that there's an option embedded in a decision? The second question, and this is a critical one, I'm going to ask, when does that option have significant economic value? Because if it doesn't, why am I wasting my time on it? And the third question I'm going to ask is, when can I use an option pricing model to value that option? So let's start the ball rolling by asking, what is it that makes an option an option? Somebody want to give me a definition of an option. What is it that makes an option an option? Give me a definition of an option. Go ahead. That's not enough, right? Lots of choices are not options. Options go beyond the choices. Rachel? The right to buy or sell something, finish the thing. Just a right to buy or sell is not an option because at a certain price. Do you see why? Because just giving you the right to buy or sell something is completely meaningless. I probably have told you the story of this MBA who walked into my office about 7 years ago. Right? And at the end of his second year MBA, he's graduating, and he comes in very proud, he's very happy. He says, my landlord has given me an option to buy my apartment where he was renting. And he says, I want to use a Black-Scholes model to value the option. I said, aren't you getting a little carried away? He says, but I've spent all this money on MBA, I want to use this Black-Scholes model. I said, okay. What price did he say you could buy the apartment at? He thought for a little while, and he says, you know what, he never mentioned a price. I said, let me get this straight. He gave you the right to buy your apartment anytime over the next year at whatever the prevailing market price is. Is that what he gave you? He said, I guess that's it. He said, what's the value of that option? Nothing. Anybody can do it. So if for it to be an option, you have to have a fixed price. So I'm going to give you what makes an option an option. An option gives you the right to buy something or sell something at a fixed price. Sometime during the next 2 years, next 5 years, next 10 years. Options are called derivative assets. You know why they're called derivative assets? Because they derive their value from something else. Options are leeches. They couldn't exist on their own. You need something of value that drives the value. So here are the things I'm going to look for in an option. What is the underlying asset? Because without an underlying asset, there can be no option. Do you get the right to buy or something, sell something at a fixed price? That creates the option. And once I can see that, I essentially have the pieces for an option. I'm going to show you the one thing that you probably should remember if you're in foundations class. Is options are best identified with their payoff diagrams. You remember payoff diagrams where I list out what the option is worth at different prices? And I'm going to show you the payoff diagram for a call option and then the payoff diagram for a put option. And I want you to tell me what makes these payoff diagrams different from any typical investment. So here's what a payoff diagram and a call option looks like. If the stock price is less than the strike price, so with a call option, you get the right to buy at a fixed price. So let's say I give you the right to buy at $50 per share. If the stock price is 20, 30, 40, 50, 45, you're not going to use that right because why would you want to use that right if you can buy it cheaper? So the stock price is less than the strike price. What do you lose? You lose whatever you paid for the option. That's it. I can't force you to buy at a different price. If the stock price ends up above 50, here's what you do. You buy at 50, you turn around and sell it at a higher price. You make the difference. That's the profit payoff. So with a call option, you have limited losses if the stock price drops and potentially unlimited profits if the stock price increases. That's a call option, a right to buy something at a fixed price. With a put option, you get the right to sell at a fixed price. And guess what? The payoff diagram just gets flipped because if I give you the right to sell at 50, you're going to exercise that right only if the stock price is 25 or 15 or 10 because the stock price is 80. Why would you want to sell to me at 50? So if you have a put option, if you look above the stock price, the loss is whatever you paid for the option. But if the stock price drops, dollar for dollar, you make profits as the price drops. Limited losses, unlimited profits. That part of what of option payoffs is what's going to come in when we talk about the valuation of an option. So that's what I'm going to do. With every real option I describe, I'm going to draw a payoff diagram. If it's a patent, a natural resource reserve, I'm going to draw a payoff diagram because that's going to be the fulcrum that's going to allow me to value these options. So if I asked you what an option is, basically think payoff diagrams. Think underlying asset, think contingent payoff. You've essentially got the framework for thinking about, is there an option embedded in a decision? So now comes the key question. And this is the question that I would suggest you ask almost any time somebody brings up the word real options. The word is exclusivity. And here's what I mean by exclusivity. You and only you have to be able to exercise the option. The right to buy at the prevailing market price has no exclusivity. Anybody can buy at the prevailing market price. But the right to buy at $1 million is an exclusive choice. So when I look at a real option, that becomes a key question. Is there exclusivity? If there is complete exclusivity, then you have a complete option. If you have partial exclusivity, you have a partial option. If there's no exclusivity, there is no option. So is there an option? Is there exclusivity? And you're going to see for every 100 options you see, only about 10 have significant economic value. Once you've identified an option, you've decided as economic value, we know the variables that determine the value of an option. We've known for since 1971 when the first option pricing models came out. And here are the six variables that determine the value of an option. And there are only six. You don't have to worry about growth rates and cash flows and cost of capital. None of those matter anymore. The first three variables relate to the underlying asset. The first is the value of the underlying asset. As that goes up and down, the value of your option will also go up and down. Think of why. You have a call option. You get the right to buy something at 50. Let's say you have the right to buy Tesla at 250. If stock price goes to 306, your call option just became more valuable. The second is the more variance there is in that value, the greater the value of all options. So this is actually something we had at the start of the class. So let me ask you a question. What is it about options that is making risk your ally? Because up till now, every time we've talked about DCF valuation, or we've talked about pricing, we've talked about higher risk going with lower value. What is it about options that makes risk your ally? Yes. That's all you need, right? Limited losses. Because if you think about it, what risk do we worry about? Upside risk or downside risk? You ever lie awake and say, oh my God, my stock is up 90%, I'm really worried. We never worry about upside risk. So the risk we worry about is downside risk. And with options, if you look at the pictures I drew, with both call and put options, what do you get? Limited losses. I've taken away the bad half of risk, which means that when you get an option, it's almost all good stuff for you. The more variance, the more risk there is in the underlying asset, the more valuable all options become, calls and puts. And the third component of the underlying asset that affects your value, and I'll explain why, is if your underlying asset pays a dividend, it can affect the value of your option, and here's why. You know what happens on, you know what the ex-dividend day is for a stock? Somebody want to tell me what the ex-dividend day is? Sam, what's the ex-dividend day? Do you remember corporate notes? The ex-dividend day is, yeah, go ahead. It's the last day by which if you buy the stock, you get the dividend. So if you don't get it on that day, the next day you actually will not get the dividend. So the ex-dividend day, what happens to the stock price? So actually, it'll stay high, but right after it goes ex-dividend, you're going to see the drop in the stock price because, you know, you now lost the dividend. You think, so what? What does a call option give you the right to do? Buy at a fixed price. So let's say tomorrow is an ex-dividend day. What do you know is going to happen tomorrow? The stock price is going to drop, and the larger the dividend, the more it's going to drop. So if you have expected dividends on a stock, it's going to lower the value of call options because it's a right to buy, and it's going to increase the value of put options. What's the value of the asset? What's the variance of that value? How much expected dividends will I get during the life of the option? There are two variables relating to the option itself. The first is the strike price. With an option, what did I give you the right to do? The right to buy at a fixed price. With a put option, I gave you the right to sell at a fixed price. Would you rather have a right to buy at a lower price or a higher price? Don't think too long. You'd rather buy at a lower price. With call options, lower strike prices translate to higher values. With put options, it's flipped around. The right to sell at a lower price is worth less than the right to sell at a higher price. And the only other option feature I have to think about is how long do I get to play this game, the life of the option. So there are two variables relating to the option. The only macro variable that affects option values is the risk-free rate. And here's why. On a call option, you get the right to buy something 2 years from now, $2 million. Let's say I gave you that right. If interest rates are 2%, the present value of what you have to pay is much higher than if interest rates are 20% or 200%. As interest rates go up, the right to buy something at a fixed price in the future is going to become more valuable because that fixed price in today's terms is going to get lower and lower. So as interest rates go up, call options will become more valuable. Put options will get less valuable because you've got to wait for 2 years to collect the cash flow. That's it. Those are the six variables. Remember those six variables because now we're going to launch into the third and final question. When can I use an option pricing model to value an option? So I'm going to cut to the chase here. Prior to 1971, people didn't know how to value options. They tried to value them like stocks and bonds by taking cash flows and adjusting for risk and doing a present value. In 1971, we started to get a breakthrough. And the breakthrough led to Fisher, Black, and Myron Scholes, the two people who came up with the option pricing model, eventually winning a Nobel Prize. Option pricing can also be incredibly mathematical and so easy to get lost. So I'm going to step back and give you the two building blocks on which all option pricing models are based. The first is the notion of a replicating portfolio. You're saying, what the heck is that? If I can create something that looks exactly like the option in terms of cash flows, and I'm going to argue that I'm going to be able to do that using the underlying asset, neither borrowing or lending. So by creating a portfolio, a replicating portfolio, I can create something that looks just like the option. That's a replicating portfolio. That's the first building block, is every option pricing model tries to create that replicating portfolio. And here's the second building block. It's arbitrage. Somebody give me a definition of arbitrage. What does it mean when we say you have arbitrage? Riskless profit. That is the key to arbitrage. You see how arbitrage plays in here? I've created a replicating portfolio and an option with exactly the same cash flows. If they traded at different prices, so let's say the replicating portfolio costs you $10 and the option costs you $11 and they have exactly the same cash flows. Create arbitrage for me, Rachel. What did you do? You'd buy one and sell the other. Which one would you buy? The cheaper one or the... You'd buy the cheaper one, so you'd buy the replicating portfolio, you'd sell the call option, you'd collect a dollar today, and because their cash flows are the same, what's going to happen? They're going to offset each other. You've essentially created a money machine. So in option pricing, we assume that that can't exist, so the two have to trade at the same price. So I'm going to show you how replication arbitrage works before I go into the Black-Scholes, because it can be, you can get lost very quickly, with what's called a binomial model. You know what a binomial model is? In a binomial model, the stock price can jump to only one of two levels. And you're going to see very quickly why to make it a binomial model. And I'm going to create this replicating portfolio for both a call and a put, so you can see the process play out with basic algebra. And after I create the replicating portfolio, I'm going to use the replicating portfolio to tell me how much the option is worth today. So let's set the example up. Let's make it a very simple example. Let's assume that you have a stock that's trading today at $50. So today the stock price is 50. 1 period from now, the stock can jump to either 70 or 35. So it's 1 year from now. Stock can either be 70 or 35. If the stock goes to 70 1 year from now, it can jump in the following year to either 100 or 50. If it goes to 35, it can jump to either 50 or 25. So it's a two-period binomial model. Do you see what I mean by binomial? At each period, you can jump to only one of two prices. Let's say I gave you a call option with a strike price of 40 today. Remember, the stock price today is 50? I give you a call option with a strike price of 40. If you exercised it right away, how much money are you going to make? You're going to buy the stock at 40. You're going to turn around and sell it at 50, and you're going to make $10, right? So if you exercise today, you're going to make $10. Set that to the side. There's always a choice. But I'm going to try to create a replicating portfolio for this call option by looking at the cash flows on the option. So help me out here. If the strike price is 40, and I get to time period 2, which is the when the option expires, if the stock price goes to 100, lead me through what you're going to do. You're going to exercise the option, buy the share at 40, you're going to sell it at 100, you're going to make $60. So your cash flow at T equal to 2 is equal to 60, which is when the option expires. If the stock goes to 50, you're going to buy at 40, sell at 50, and you're going to make 10. If the stock goes to 25, you're going to buy at 25 and sell at 40 and lose 15. Come on, why are you following me down that path? You don't have to. It's a right, right? It's not an obligation. If the stock goes to 25, what are you going to do? You're going to take the option. You're going to throw it in the trash can. And your cash flow at that point in time at least is 0. 60, 10, and 0 are the cash flows on the option. So I know the cash flows on the option. What am I going to try to do? I'm going to try to create a replicating portfolio. And to create that replicating portfolio, I'm going to combine borrowing money and buying shares of stock in the company. And the key here is to decide how much to borrow and how much to buy. So I'm going to take you back probably to 7th or 8th grade. I don't know which grade this was when you did simultaneous equations. Remember those? Two equations, two unknowns. You work long and hard enough, the two unknowns should become knowns. So here's what I have. I have two unknowns. I don't know how much to borrow and how much to buy. Let's call how much I'm going to borrow B and how much I'm going to buy D. I'm being incredibly creative here. If the stock goes to 70, and I always have to start at the last branch, here's what I want to do. I want to go out and buy delta shares of stock and borrow B dollars, and whatever that portfolio does, its cash flows have to be equal to what the option would deliver. So stock goes to 100, 100 times D will be what my stock is worth. I have to pay back my borrowing with interest. Let's say the interest rate is 11%, so 1.11 times B has to be equal to 60. So that's if the stock goes to 100, my replicating portfolio's cash flows have to be 60. If the stock goes to 50, I go through the same mechanics. 50 times delta minus 1.11 beta has to be equal to 10. Two equations, two unknowns. I solve for delta and B. The delta I get is 1. And the B I get is 36.04. You say, what does that even mean? If I go out and borrow $36.04 and buy one share of stock at $70 at T equal to 1, I will get exactly the same cash flows as buying a call option with a strike price of 40. I've created my replicating portfolio. Buying one share of stock at 70 with borrowing $36 means I have to come up with $33.96 to create that replicating portfolio. Now comes the arbitrage argument. If I can create the replicating portfolio for $33.96, the value of the call option also has to be $33.96. I have a value for the call if the stock goes to 70. Let me try this out on if the stock goes to 35 to see if you can, if you can go through with the mechanics one more time in case it didn't catch the first time. Stock goes to 35. I want exactly the same objective. I want to go out and borrow B dollars and buy delta shares of stock, and I want my cash flows to be exactly the same as the cash flows on the call. So stock goes to 50, 50 times D minus the borrowing with interest paid back has to be equal to 10. 25 times D minus the interest with the borrowing has to be equal to 0. I solve for delta and B, and the stock goes to 35. Here's what I need to do. I need to go out and borrow $9.01 and buy 0.4 shares of stock. Don't even ask me how you buy 0.4 shares of stock. You've got to work that out in your head. And I will create something that looks exactly like the call, and since that cost me $4.99, I got a value for the call of $4.99. So now I have a value for the call if the stock goes to 70, $33.96. A value for the call if it goes to 35, $4.99. I go back one extra step. I ask the same question. If I have to go out and borrow B dollars today and buy delta shares of stock, what would I need to do to be equal to $33.96 if the stock goes to 70 or $4.99? Now do you see why I always have to start with the last leg and move one step at a time? When I do that, here's what I get as my answer. If I borrow $21.61 today, so B is equal to 21.61, and buy 0.8278 shares of stock today, I will create something that replicates a call at every single step of the process. It's a self-funding portfolio. And since that portfolio cost me $19.42, the value of a call option today is 1942. What would you have made by exercising the call? $10, right, if you did it? But by holding the call, by treating it as an option, it's worth $19.42. Replication arbitrage. Let me ask you a question. Sam, your question? Yeah. The stock is trading at 70, right?
Is it assuming that the $100 payout, $50 payout, the probabilities?
You don't even need the probabilities because all you need is the cash flows to match up because the probabilities are going to be the same for both the replicating portfolio and the option. Do you see what Sam had a very good question. Normally when you draw decision trees, you have probabilities attached to the branches, right? 60% up, 40% down. Because I'm creating two investments that have exactly the same cash flows, whatever your probability might pick, doesn't matter. And that's one of the great things about option pricing is I don't have to think about what's the likelihood of going. As long as I create the replicating portfolio, I'm okay. I'm in a riskless position. Yeah.
And just not from a mathematical perspective, but intuitively, why when the stock price goes up 20 from 50 to 70,
yeah,
does the call price not go up?
It does, right? It goes 90. Oh, why does it not go up $20? Because a time premium doesn't increase proportionately with the stock price. The more in the money you get, the less time premium there is to the option. Because at 50, my potential upside is I could go all the way up to 100. At 70, my potential upside has become much smaller, right? There's only $30. So as you move through the branches, you're going to start to see as you get into the further and further into the upper branches, the time premium is going to shrink because you're already at a pretty positive outcome. There's not much upside left in the game. It's not linear. It really depends on how the decision tree plays out. Yes? Right. Yeah. No, the 50 is the stock, right? So if you bought the stock, it'll go down to 25. But remember that because you created the replicating portfolio, you didn't buy one share. You only have, as the stock price goes down, look at what you're doing. You started with 0.8278 shares, right? If the stock price goes down, what do you do to your shareholding? It drops to 0.4 shares. So as the stock price goes down, you're actually reducing your exposure to the equity. As the stock price goes up, you're increasing exposure. That's why you don't drop proportionately, and that's what creates a replicating portfolio. Now, let me ask you a question. This is kind of a trick question, but if you can answer it, you kind of are getting a sense of the math behind this. I made this a binomial distribution, right? Two branches. Why did I have to make it a binomial distribution? Why not a trinomial, quadrinomial, or whatever, polynomial? Why did I do it a binomial? Sam, you want to try?
Because if you made it a trinomial more, you have to have probabilities.
If you have trinomial, how many equations will I have? Three equations. How many unknowns do I have? Two unknowns. If you have two unknowns and three equations, you know what happens? It's algebra hell. Everything breaks loose. There's no unique solution. It's because I have only two unknowns. How much should I borrow? How many shares of stock do I need to buy? That kind of restricts me. It's restrictive because you have a binomial. Most investments don't move to one of two points the next minute or the next hour. They could go to 100 potential points. So it's very artificial, but it's a great way to illustrate how replication or arbitrage works. But let's say you decide to use this approach to value a three-month call option. Three-month call option is not that long, right? You go to the CBOE, you can get a three-month call option. To have even the remotest chance of having a binomial distribution, you have to make time really small. You can't make it a day. Too many things can happen in a day. How about a second? That's a chance, right? So all you have to do is draw binomial trees in little seconds. How many seconds are there in 3 months? I don't expect an answer. A lot of seconds. So let's say you're one of those very patient people. You sit there with this gigantic sheet of paper with a really sharp pencil and you start drawing binomial trees 1 second at a time. And you draw the entire tree. Take a look at it. What does it look like? Bunch of little branches, right? Let's flip the entire tree picture over on its side. What you have will look like a pine tree with no trunk to it because your branch is all the way through. Hang in there. You're saying, where the hell is this guy going with this? Smooth out the outside of the pine tree. So instead of having these sharpened edges, you now have smoothed it out. What does it start to look like? It starts to look like a normal distribution. If as I make time smaller, the price changes also become smaller, the binomial distribution becomes a normal distribution, and the binomial option pricing model, which I just described, becomes the Black-Scholes option pricing model. When people talk about the Black-Scholes option pricing model, they often talk about continuous price distribution. Say, what the hell are you talking about? Continuous price distributions basically mean that for prices to change, they have to change in really tiny increments. The way the stock goes from 30 to 50 in a continuous price world, it goes 30, 30.01, 30.02, 30.03, it doesn't jump. Is that realistic? Do stock prices actually jump in the real world all the time? The Black-Scholes model is built on an assumption that is unrealistic, but it gets at all this good stuff. So we make that assumption about continuous price distributions. In fact, there are versions of the option pricing model that allow for jump processes, prices to jump. Nobody ever uses those models because they're almost impossible to use practically. The parameters are so difficult to estimate that we talk about it, but I've never seen somebody use it sensibly. It's very difficult to do. So the limiting case for the binomial is the Black-Scholes. So I'm going to list out probably the most famous equation in finance. More famous than the CAPM, if that is possible, which is the Black-Scholes option pricing model. This is your ticket to show you've arrived. This is how you intimidate non-finance people. You pull out the Black-Scholes model. You've seen the Black-Scholes? I can use the Black-Scholes. So I'm going to equip you with the intimidation factor you need to push all those marketing and strategy people to the background. Okay? So here's what the Black-Scholes model does. It estimates the value of an option based on five variables. S, which is the value of the underlying asset, K, which is the strike price, T, which is the life of the option, R, which is the riskless rate, and question mark squared. No, actually, sigma squared. I don't know, again, why Microsoft Word does this to me. But change the question mark squared to a sigma squared, the variance of the underlying. Five variables. Wait, didn't we say there were six variables that determine the value of an option? What am I missing here? Let me go back and show you the six variables, and you tell, because this is too easy. Which variable am I missing? Value of the underlying asset is there, Fernando. Expected dividends. You say, what the hell happened? I'm going to tell you a story, and I don't even know whether this is a true story, but such a good story, might as well believe it's true. In 1971, Fisher Black and Myron Scholes were at the University of Chicago. They were in the finance department. They were working on this option pricing model. And they got to the stage where they had an equation, and they didn't know how to solve it because nobody in finance had ever seen an equation like this one. It required what was called stochastic calculus to solve, and nobody in finance even knew what stochastic calculus was. And here's where the rumored story begins. A physics PhD student was wandering through the finance department, don't ask me why, wandered into their office, don't ask me why, took a look at the equation, don't ask me why, and wrote out the solution immediately. He said, in first year physics, we do this all the time, we use what's called Itô's lemma. To which your response is, who the hell is Itô? And why does he have all these lemmas? But it turns out that in physics, this is actually stochastic calculus as part of the toolkit you bring to solve that equation. To cut a long story short, Fisher Black and Myron Scholes had so much trouble with that equation that they decided it wasn't worth bringing dividends in. It was too much of a pain. So they assumed away dividends. They did what economists do when they have a problem. They assume the problem away. Look, no problem. It's gone. In fact, the original Black-Scholes was designed to value what are called dividend-protected stocks. What are dividend-protected stocks? Remember what I said, why you worried when you had a call option? When dividend is paid, the stock price drops. That's why I worried. On a dividend-protected option, here's what I do. If I pay a dollar dividend, I also adjust the exercise price by the dollar so you're not hurt. Are there any dividend-protected options anywhere in the world? I've never seen one. But the original Black-Scholes was designed to value dividend-protected options. And in that world, here's what the option pricing model looks like. It takes those five variables, S, K, R, T, and sigma. It plugs them into these equations to get D1 and D2. Hang in there with me. You're saying, what the hell is D1 and D2? D1 and D2 are intermediate stops. So you use all the numbers to come up with D1 and D2. Then they take the D1 and D2 into what's called a cumulative normal distribution. You've all seen normal distributions in statistics books. They give you the height of the distribution. Cumulative normal distribution, look at the area of the distribution. And here's what the cumulative normal distribution ranges from, 0 to 1. So you compute D1, you go to the distribution, you compute the area under the distribution. You do the same thing with D2, N of D2. I'm going to give you an intuitive explanation of N of D1 and N of D2 in a moment, but essentially the D1 and D2 are intermediate stops that allow you to come up with N of D1 and N of D2. Then they go back and they plug it in. They say the value of a call option is S, which is the value of the stock today, times N of D1 minus KE minus RT. You say, what the hell is E minus RT? Option pricing is going to require you to use all those buttons on your calculator that I call virgin buttons. Buttons that have never been touched so far. Okay? Like that exponential button. You say, what the hell is that for? E minus RT is just a present value factor. In continuous time, you know how we normally take present value? That's all he's doing. He's saying the strike price doesn't have to be paid till 2 years from now. So if you don't have an exponential button on your calculator, just take the present value of the strike price. It'll work just as well. Trust me on this one. So K E minus RT is just the present value of the strike price. And embedded in the Black-Scholes is the replicating portfolio. Remember how we solved for D and B in the binomial model? The ND1 shares of stock become the D in the model. So essentially, in the Black-Scholes, I've created what I had in the binomial as D. And KE minus RT times ND2 becomes the B, the borrowing that I have to do. So the Black-Scholes model, the most useful part is not the output, but what comes into the output. Because embedded there are all the numbers you need to be able to understand the replicating portfolio. So if you go out and borrow the present value of the strike price times ND2, I know it sounds incredibly abstract, and you buy ND1 shares of stock, you've essentially replicated the call. That ND1 is called the option delta. You know what the option gamma is? As the stock price changes, as variance changes, as time changes, both ND1 and the borrowing are going to... Everything in option pricing is built off this replicating portfolio. The option gamma tells you how the delta will change as your variance changes. The option theta will tell you how the value of the option, the delta will change as time change. I'm sorry, as option theta is what I said, as time changes. So essentially, you can take every input in the model and look to see how your replicating portfolio will change, and you've essentially got the entire language of option pricing in front of you. So don't let an option trader ever intimidate you. They're going to talk Vega, Gamma, Theta. They love the Greek alphabet. Take it back from them. Everything in option pricing is built around the replicating portfolio and how that replicating portfolio will change as the stock price changes, as time changes. So essentially, it's going through the variables that determine what that replicating portfolio will do. So Black-Scholes model looks incredibly intimidating until you step back and say, that's a replicating portfolio in front of me, and it's going to tell me what the value of a call is by using replication arbitrage. Now, one of the limitations of Black-Scholes, of course, is it did not have dividends. And the reality is most of the options that we will be valuing as real options will have a dividend-like component to them. So I'm going to give you the adjustment you can make to the Black-Scholes to allow you to use it on an asset that pays a dividend. And here's what I'm going to do. Let's say you have a 5-year option, and you expect a dividend yield of 1% on the stock every year for the next 5 years. What do we say happens to your stock price when the dividend gets paid? It's going to drop by roughly the dividend, right? So if I tell you there's a 1% dividend yield every year for the next 5 years, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take today's stock price and reduce it by 1% a year for the period of the option. That's what the E minus YT does. It's like a present value factor, reducing the stock price today for expected dividends in the future. So it's going to make my stock price lower and the value of my call lower. The other adjustment you're going to see is inside the D1 and D2, you're going to notice the dividend yield pops in. And here's the way to think about it. What do you do with your replicating portfolio? You borrow money and you buy shares, right? When you borrow money, you've got to make interest payments. When you buy shares in this world, now you're going to get dividends. So your dividends pay for some of your riskless rate. So R minus V is like a carrying cost. You see this often in futures and options. It's what you have to bear to carry this position. So those two adjustments essentially bring dividends into the model and allow you to use the Black-Scholes model to value an asset that pays a dividend. That's it. That's all the option pricing you will need to take away from your undergraduate business degree, because everything else is just icing on the cake. If you get replication arbitrage, you got option pricing nailed down. Everything else then becomes an extension of that concept. One final point. If you look at this ND2, this model, it actually has a very special meaning in option pricing. It's called a risk-neutral probability that your option will be in the money. So let me repeat that again. ND2, so let's say ND2 is 0.6, because basically you can see ND2 gets pulled off this number. Say the ND2 is 0.6. I'm saying there's a 60% chance that this option will be in the money by the time the option expires. So it's a probability that you can then use to say this is the likelihood of something happening. So with that homework done, let's close the process of just thinking about option pricing. If you're a purist, and there are lots of purists in the real options world, they will tell you you cannot use a Black-Scholes model to value a real option. And they actually have a good case, and here's why. The original Black-Scholes was designed to value what are called European options. So unfortunately, we've attached a geographical name to it. What separates European options from American options? Sam? European options can be exercised only at expiration. American options can be exercised any time up to expiration. Let's stay on this. Holding all else constant, should American options be worth more than European options or less? They have the same characteristics. They should be worth more because you get that right to exercise early. The original Black-Scholes was designed to value European options. Almost every real option we're going to talk about will come with a possibility, not really a probability of early exercise. So the purists say you shouldn't be using Black-Scholes. You should be using a binomial model to value real options. And my response is, you're right, but show me. Show me in what sense? Actually, using the binomial model requires you to do what? Draw that binomial tree, right? If you can draw the binomial tree, I'll go along with you. But drawing the binomial tree is so incredibly messy that I'd much rather use the Black-Scholes and get a conservative. You see why it's going to be a conservative estimate? Because it's going to give me a lower bound on the value than trying to negotiate my way with the binomial model. So you're going to see me use the Black-Scholes with no shame. I'm going to use it accepting the fact that it's not perfect, but also accepting the fact that the alternatives are not pragmatic. Okay? One other thing that I want to point out is, you know, as Sam said, you could put probabilities on these trees, and if you did that, you'd end up with a decision tree, which is in statistics, you take the expected value. You're no longer talking about option pricing. It's actually easy to show that if you can draw a full-fledged decision tree with the probabilities at every branch, and you no longer have to be binomial, right? You can create as many branches as you want. What you get as an expected value from that decision tree will actually be the exact same value that you get with an option pricing model. So what does that mean? If you can draw a decision tree, just do the decision tree. Don't bring a bazooka launcher to kill an ant. I mean, people pull out bring out the option pricing technology when you really need it. Because most of the time, you really don't need it. There are far simpler ways you can get to the value. Just use those far simpler ways, and let's not talk about option pricing in those contexts. So, in fact, I know the place I use decision trees the most is in the pharmaceutical business. And it fits, right? Because especially we have a young pharmaceutical company working its way through the pipeline. At every stage in the process, you have probabilities and you have expected values. This is actually a valuation of a single drug company, a company that had come up with a drug to treat diabetes. And essentially, it looks at all the possible outcomes, ranging from complete failure to the drug being an incredible success, and takes an expected value. I don't need an option pricing model to value this. I could do it with a decision tree, but only because I was willing to attach probabilities at every branch. So let's talk about real options. There are three questions. With every one of the real options I'm going to describe to you, I'm going to ask three questions. First is there an option in this decision? I want to make sure that I'm not talking about options in places where options don't belong. In fact, the paper I have on options on my website is called Opportunities Are Not Options, because a lot of people mistake the two. Just because you have potential doesn't mean you can talk about options. Second, I'm going to ask, is there exclusivity? Is there a significant economic value? And third, I'm going to ask, is this an option where I can actually use an option pricing model? You're saying, what are you talking about? To use an option pricing model, I need to be able to replicate, and I need to be able to do arbitrage. Replicate, what do I need to do? I need to be able to trade the underlying asset. I need to be able to trade the option. If I can't do that, I can't do replication. So let's talk about options in investment analysis. traditional way we've all been taught to do capital budgeting is take the present value of the cash flow, subtract out the initial investment, come up with the net present value. As I said, there are three options that we miss when we do this. The first is the option to delay, where having the exclusive rights to a bad project can still have value. The second is the option to expand, where doing a bad project gives you the right to good projects in the future, big projects. And the third is the option to abandon. And I'm going to argue that until you deal with the values of these options, you really cannot tell me that a project is truly a bad project, the loss cost. So let's start with the option to delay. And as I said, with every one of these options, here's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to first draw a payoff diagram so you can see exactly where the optionality comes from, and then use that payoff diagram to value the option. So here's the setup. When you look at a project, you compute the present value of the cash flows, you look at the initial investment, you make a decision, net present value is bad. But let's say you have the exclusive rights to this project for the next 5, the next 10, the next 15 years. Let me draw the payoff diagram and you tell me whether it looks like an option. What you need to invest in this project becomes the equivalent of the strike price. So if the value of the cash flow stays below the strike price for the rest of eternity, what happens? That exclusive right you paid for goes into the trash can and says, I wish I hadn't done that. But if the value of the cash flows increases, as Louise pointed, good things can happen, then I take the difference and that becomes a good project. The underlying asset here is the project on which you have the exclusive rights. The value of the underlying asset becomes the present value of the cash flows from doing that project today. The strike price becomes the initial investment. And I can value it like any other option. So I'm going to use this option to delay example in two contexts. You know how pharmaceutical companies, technology companies get patents? What are the two ways you can get a patent as a company? One is you can do it yourself by doing R&D. The other is you can buy a patent. So let's think about the value of a patent. Let's assume that you have a patent, and here's what it gives you. The right to convert the patent to a commercial product. That's what you get with a patent. Let's say the cost of converting the patent into a commercial product is I. And based on what you know today, the value of the cash flows you think you will get from converting the patent is V. If V is greater than I, you convert the patent, you make the value. But V is less than I, what are you going to do? You're not going to throw the patent away. You're just going to sit and wait. Wait and hope what happens, that V somehow becomes greater than I. So if you were to draw a payoff diagram for a patent, here's what it'll look like. The cost of converting the patent into a product becomes a strike price. The value of the cash flows you will get by converting it becomes the equivalent of the stock price, the underlying asset. How long do you have these rights for the patent? Until the patent runs out, which could be 15 years, 70 years, that becomes the life of the option. Is it possible that you invest in a patent and it turns out to be not viable for the next 17 years? Sure. I think IBM owns 4,500 patents. One of the largest patent holders in the world. 4,000 of those patents will never be worth a thing. Because you patent things and hope that something good happens. But that's okay. That's the way patents work. And if you arrive at the conclusion the patent is not going to work, what do you lose if that happens? It's whatever you paid to get the patent, the R&D expenditure, the price you paid. So that becomes equivalent to the price of the option. If the patent becomes viable, you develop the patent, you make the difference. So there you have your call option. So let's set up the framework. If you have to value an option, how we would get the inputs you would need to value the patent. So let me go through the inputs, and as we go along, think about how you would try to estimate it. So I come to you with a patent on a product and say, value this patent as an option. The first thing you need to do is value the underlying project, right? So here's what I'd suggest you do. Do a traditional capital budgeting. What does that mean? Project out the cash flows, come up with the cost of capital, take the present value. That present value of the cash flows from developing the patent today will become the S in the model. And as you're doing this, you're going to complain. You know why I'm going to complain? He said, there's so much uncertainty. Don't ask me to do this. And I'm going to say, that's exactly what's going to give this option value. Make your best estimates and just give me the expected cash flow. So that becomes the S in the model. The second input I need is the variance in that value. And this becomes messy. Because when you do a traditional capital budgeting, you get one set of cash flows and one value. You don't get a variance in that number. It's not a traded asset. So there are two ways you can get that variance. One is, remember Monte Carlo simulations we talked about where instead of giving one input, we put in a distribution? I could do a capital budgeting where instead of giving one number for the revenues and one number for the market share, I gave you distributions. You came up with a distribution of values for this project and you gave me a standard deviation. In fact, Crystal Ball actually has a real options add-on that you can pay for. Don't waste your money on paying for it because you're basically just, it'll just give you conventional terms, but you could do this in traditional Crystal Ball. The standard deviation across your values becomes the standard deviation of variance in this new cash flows. If you're too lazy to do that or you don't have the information to do that, here's a cheating way of getting the variance. Let's say you have a biotechnology company. It's a biotechnology patent. Here's what you can do. You can look at the publicly traded stock prices of biotech companies, take the variance in those stock prices and make a leap of faith saying that's going to be the variance in my cash flows and use that as your variance in value. So I've got S, I've got sigma. The exercise price in the option is the cost of converting the option into a commercial product. So you've got to estimate what it'll cost you to build a factory, hire a sales force, that becomes a K. The life of the option is very simple. It's however many years are left in your patent. If it's 15 years, that becomes the life of the option. And now I'm going to introduce a final variable, and you'll see very quickly why I need this. With a traditional option, an option that you buy in the CBOE, almost no one exercises an option early. In other words, you buy a call option on, let's say you bought a call option on Tesla when the stock was at 220. You made a good bet, right? The stock's at 305. So you can exercise the option and collect your profits, or you can do what? What's your other choice if you don't want to exercise? Sell it to somebody else, and if you sell it to somebody else, you get whatever the exercise value is plus a premium. With listed traded options, you almost never get early exercise because you can always sell it to somebody else and get the exercise value plus a premium. I don't want that to happen with a patent, and think of why. You have 17 years left in the patent. Do you want to wait 16 years and 364 days before you decide on the very last day of your patent protection, I'm going to develop the patent today? I don't think so. Because if you wait that long, what have you lost? What did the patent give you? Protection from competition, right? By waiting so long, you've given up most of the protection. So I'm going to introduce what I call a cost of delay. And what that basically is going to mean is you'll have a trade-off. You can exercise this option right away, but if you do, you give up, or you can wait. If you exercise the option right away, you get the value, but if you wait, what you give up is 1 year of protection you could have had. So in year one, with 15 years left, if this patent becomes viable, and you choose to wait, you give up one of the 15 years of protection. That's going to be like I call it a cost of delay, but it's going to act like a dividend yield because it basically reduces the value of your underlying asset. So I'm going to use this to kind of illustrate it. I'm going to illustrate this with a very simple example way back in time. It's a drug called Avonex. It's an actual drug that was patented in 1997 by a biotech company called Biogen. It's still around, but that time it was a young company. One of the drugs, and it was a blockbuster drug potentially. It was a drug to treat MS, big market. And the reason I'm going to stick with this example is I got information on this example that I generally am not able to get. What Biogen actually did was they did a traditional capital budgeting on whether they should develop the drug right away. Have you ever seen pharmaceutical companies actually estimate cash flows for a drug? It's kind of scary. Here's how they do it. They start off by estimating what percentage of the population has MS. It's fairly simple to do. Then they take the percentage of those people who will go to a doctor, which is not 100%. Then they'll take the percentage of people who go to a doctor who will get the right diagnosis, and it's not 100%. And then they'll get the percent of people who get the right diagnosis who have the money to buy the right drug, which is not 100%. So it's actually these layers, and when they're done, they'll have the number of potential patients who will buy Avonex. They put a price, they come up with cash flows, they discount them back, and they did that and came up with a value of $3,422 million. So file that away. That's the present value of the cash flows from developing the drug right away. They estimated that to develop this drug as a commercial drug, they'd never actually produced a drug on their own before. They licensed other drugs out, but they'd never done this. They'd have to build an entire infrastructure, and it would cost them $2.875 billion. So let me pause right there. If they develop the drug right now, it'll cost them $2.875 billion, and they will get $3,422 million. as the present value of the cash flows. If this were a capital budgeting exercise, what's the net present value of this project? It's going to be the difference between those two numbers, 3,422 minus 2,875, which is 547 million. So file that away, that is the discounted cash flow value of this project. But here's where the optionality kicks in. They haven't developed the drug yet. They have 17 years of protection left, and the riskless rate is 6.7%. And this is an incredibly risky business. Lots of uncertainty. How uncertain? Well, the industry average variance in biotech firms is about 0.224. Huge amount of uncertainty. And it's true, this is a viable drug, that by not developing it, they're giving up one out of the 17 years of protection. So I'm going to put that in as my cost of delay. I plugged it in, D1, D2 into the Black-Scholes, N of D. So you remember the process. And I got a value for the call of 907 million. Remind me again what the net present value of this project was. 547 million. What's the value of this drug as an option? 907 million. Remember I said the key to optionality is you put a premium on a DCF? I'm attaching a $360 million premium to my discounted cash flow valuation. Why? Because I'm uncertain about the future, and uncertainty has now magically become my ally. The value of this drug as an option is 907 million. And there's some really bad news in this option pricing model for you if you have MS. I'm not saying any of you do, but if you did have MS. And here's why. What's this value coming from? It's coming from the fact that if you wait, this drug could be worth more, right? In fact, if I develop the drug today, what happens the instant I develop the drug? It becomes a traditional project with a net present value of 547 million. So you're going to be sitting at home saying, I've heard of this blockbuster drug. How come they're not developing it? And the answer is, the optionality is holding them back. In fact, how long will it hold them back? If nothing changes, it'll take about 8 years before the cost of delay becomes large enough for you to actually develop the drug. So you'll be sitting for 8 years waiting for the drug. Why? Because by waiting, Biogen actually gets a higher value than by developing the drug. I'm going to temper that bad news because Biogen actually developed the drug about a year or two into the process, not 8 years in. So there must be something I'm messing up in my inputs, right? So what do you think is causing Biogen to develop the drug sooner than I thought it would? Luis?
Is it like a moral issue?
I wish it were that issue, but I'm not afraid it's not. Right? How many years of protection did I say they had? 17 years, right? What am I implicitly assuming? That they don't develop it for the next 17 years, they're the only game in town. Is that true? What does a patent give you the right to? The right to develop this drug to treat MS. What do they have to worry about? That Merck and Upjohn and Pfizer are coming up with their own drugs to treat MS, which might get developed in 3 years. In fact, the way they saw it is one of these companies would come out with the drug in about 5 to 6 years. You're saying, what's that going to change? Instead of giving up, if you think about the number of years of protection they have, they don't have 17 years of protection. They have about 5 before the next best drug comes along. The cost to delay becomes 1/5. If the cost to delay goes up, the option value collapses. But here's the bottom line. If you have a monopoly pharmaceutical company, what does it tell you about how quickly drugs will get developed if you have monopoly? You have 100% of the market for the ulcer drug. Why wouldn't you going to come up with the... Even if it's a better drug, you're going to say, well, I'm just going to cannibalize my own sales. So if you can create competition among different companies with drugs for the same disease, you are going to get quicker development because, in a sense, you want the optionality to become much smaller. If the optionality becomes large, companies are not going to develop drugs, even if they become viable. Yes? No, this has already been approved. So actually, they were approved already. So if there was a probability of getting approved, you'd have to put a front on this. So let's say there's a 60% chance of approval. Both the option value and your DCF value would have to be adjusted for that 60% chance of approval. Let's close today by just bringing this all together. So let's say I ask you to value a pharmaceutical company. Almost every pharmaceutical company has developed drugs and patents. The way we usually value in a DCF is we put them all together, we get a collective cash flow, we assume a growth rate based on the fact that they're promising patents, we do a traditional discounted cash flow valuation. Here's another way in which you could value a pharmaceutical company. You could value the developed drugs as a cash flow stream with a discounted cash flow model. You can value the patents as options, like I did for Avonex. And then in the third stream, you can value whatever they gain by having an ongoing R&D department. Let me kind of back this with Biogen. I told you Biogen already had some licensed drugs. They didn't have any drugs they produced on their own. Their licensed drug, two drugs, had already been licensed out, and they were getting fixed cash flows on these drugs. There are two ways you can license a drug. One is you can license a drug to get a fixed payment from an Upjohn or a Pfizer every year, or you can license a drug to get a percentage of revenues. This is going to be important. They license the drugs to get a fixed amount of $50 million a year every year for the next 12 years. So that's my first slice, is I know I'm going to get $50 million a year for the next 12 years. To value that $50 million a year for the next 12 years, I discounted those cash flows at the pre-tax cost of debt of Upjohn and Pfizer. What the hell am I doing? Aren't we supposed to use a discount rate, a cost of capital as a discount rate? Why am I using the pre-tax cost of debt as my discount rate on these $50 million cash flows? What's the rule on discounting cash flows? The discount rate has to reflect the risk in those cash flows, right? What's the risk you're not going to get the $50 million? If those companies default, you're not going to get the $50 million. The pre-tax cost of debt captures the default risk. So I take the present value of $50 million at the pre-tax cost of debt. I come up with $397 million. That's the value of my licensed drugs. The value of Biogen was $907 million. There's only one final slice, and this is the messier slice. Biogen has a continuing R&D department. That R&D right now has $100 million in expenses. You expect those expenses to grow about 20% a year for the next 10 years and 5% thereafter. So you know what the expenses are going to look like. And here I'm going to make an assumption. I'm going to make an assumption that a dollar invested in R&D creates $1.25 in value. So if I were thinking in terms of return on capital and cost of capital, what am I assuming about the return on capital for this company? Higher than the cost of capital or lower? It's going to be higher. That's where the extra 25 cents. In fact, if I assume that return on capital is equal to cost of capital, a dollar invested in R&D will create a dollar in value. It's exactly going to offset. But it's going to be only for the next 10 years. Beyond 10 years, it's going to become a zero value asset. I'm all set. Last piece in the process, here's what I did. I took the R&D. So let's say year one, R&D is $120 million. That's my expected R&D cost. Because I'm creating $1.25 in value for every dollar invested, my value that I create in patents is $150 million. The difference, the excess value, is $30 million. And I do that for every year for the next 10 years, and I stop after 10 years. Why do I stop after 10 years? Because I assume that after 10 years, it becomes a neutral value business. You take the present value of those value created, and I'm going to use a really high discount rate on this because these are drugs I don't even know will be created. I'm assuming these are 15% cost of capital. What I get as a present value is $318.3 million. So I have three slices at Biogen. The first slice is the $397 million in licensed drugs, the $50 million discounted back. The second slice is Avonex as a patent. The third slice is future R&D. You add them all up, the value that you get for Biogen as a company is $1.622 billion. Add cash, subtract. So from that point on, I can treat it like the value of operating assets in a DCF model. Now do you see why you would never want to use this if you're valuing a Glaxo or a Upjohn or a Pfizer? You have hundreds of patents. Can you imagine sitting there trying to value each one as an option? This is really an approach that's best suited for small pharmaceutical companies, really young biotech companies, one or two drugs. I think you can actually use this approach to value the company. The one note of caution I would add is don't double count. Know what I mean by double counting? Don't value the patents as options and also give them a high growth rate because that high growth rate is coming from those options. This is an alternative way of investing. So let me close off asking the three questions. Is there an option embedded in a patent? Absolutely. Why? Because there's an underlying asset, there's a contingent payoff, and those contingent payoffs create options. Second, is there economic value? Where does the economic value come from here? Where does the exclusivity come from patents? You and only you can develop the patents. And what does that depend on? How well the patent law is enforced. If you're in a part of the world where you have a patent but nobody enforces the patent, the value of the option will go towards zero. And third, can I use an option pricing model? I'm really stretching it, right? Because if you think about what I need for an option pricing model, I need to be able to trade the underlying asset and trade the option. The underlying asset here is the Avonex, the drug. I can't trade that. I can't trade the option. I'm really stretching, which doesn't mean I can't put a number on the option, but monetizing that number, the $907 million you saw for Avonex, is going to be really tough to do. So let's, when we after the quiz, I'm going to apply this option to delay on undeveloped natural resources, oil companies, gold mining companies, because I'm going to use the same kind of argument for valuing those undeveloped reserves as I did for patents. So I'll see you on Monday.
That's what keeps listed options at that option price, is if the price wanders away, then I can step in and do arbitrage. So since there's no mechanism I can use here, the value of Avonex, the actual traded value can go to $685 million. I can look at it and say that's too low, but I can't claim the difference because I can't trade on the underlying asset. So it's not even the continuous price. The very fact that I cannot trade on it means I cannot do the replication that's so much a part of the option price. No, because remember, options are going to be priced by the market. They're not priced by Black-Scholes, right? So what will happen is if there's a big price jump up, if you apply the Black-Scholes model on the option, you're going to find all of them to be cheap. You say, what the hell is going on? Because what the market is saying is, look, there's a price jump coming. We're going to build that into the options. So it's called the volatility skew. So if you've seen options, you'll actually see that the further out of the money an option becomes, the more the implied volatility is. Because with the traditional Black-Scholes model, you get really way out of the money. The Black-Scholes model says you never get from 31 to 50, because the way you get from 31 to 50 is go 31, 31.01, 31.02. So the deep out of the money options in Black-Scholes, you're going to get a very low value. But in the market, that value will be higher because you can get from 30 to 50 if there's a jump. So what will happen is, as you get options that are at the money, Black-Scholes does a pretty good job. The further out of the money you get, especially, you know, deep out of the money options, the more the Black-Scholes model will underprice options because of this continuous price. Let's face it, insurance is an option business, right? Whenever you write insurance, what are you doing? What's State Farm doing? When you buy insurance in your car, they're selling you a put option on your car, right? Or selling a put option on all insurance is just option pricing. So think about, so Geico is the lifeblood that drives Berkshire Hathaway. In the insurance business, they sell options. So sometimes when Buffett says that he often said terrible things about option trading and how horrible it is, I think he's being a little hypocritical, because his entire business is built on the notion of options. Over the last few years, he's become more willing to actually sell options, because what he feels is when volatility is high, people forget the fact that there's a fade factor, that high volatility fades back. So what they do is they price the options based, let's say right after the crisis. Okay. Option prices jump because volatility was high. And what Buffett said was, look, it's not going to stay high forever. So if I'm buying a 10-year call or a put, I shouldn't be pricing it with a 50% standard deviation. And if you are, I'll sell you as many options as you want. So that's what he was talking about when he's selling long-term options, is sometimes when people get over... So it's not even the constant volatility. It's when volatility jumps, they assume it's going to stay at that level for the long term. They're, in a sense, paying too much for options, and he says, I'll sell you those options.
And it's not hypocritical in every sense, I guess. Because in the insurance argument, he's basing it off of
The insurance rationale is simpler, right? Because the reason you have to buy insurance for your car or your auto is this is it's this or nothing, right? You'll have no insurance, you have to buy